VentureCast.
Ben, you know who I don't like out of this genre? And they kind of ruined the whole genre in a way.
Depeche Mode, that was my entree to this genre, and it really crushed me.
Yeah, that'll do it. I'm out of Depeche Mode, yeah.
And I have since come around to some Smith songs and some Cure songs.
Yeah, right.
I have not come around to much Depeche Mode. And just to
dude,
be
I'm
frank,
sorry, but that reach out and that what's the Personal Jesus? That song is fantastic. I don't care what anybody says. That you're my own bird. When that comes on the radio, turn it up. And just pretend like you're the Depeche Mode dude, and you will feel like a god. Singing along to that song is so unbelievably fun.
Reach out and touch me.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Fellas.
Timmy!
What the heck is going on? So,
okay.
Pause all discussion of 1983, because what needs to be discussed is September 30th, 2021. I wasn't there. Jeff, you had your CD release concert.
I did have my CD release concert.
Ben,
and I was joined by fellow celebrity, Ben Barton.
We did have at least one podcast listener who was really into both me and Jeff, which made us pretty happy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He said he had a lot of thoughts about Diver Down, and then I just left. I didn't listen to him. So it's perfect. He can catch me next time I'm out there.
That's
Cal,
right.
We love you, brother. Keep listening. I love that you did that to Ben. I wish you'd been able to
corner him.
I know, dude. He can email me. I'm available. I also have a lot of thoughts on Diver Down. So
we are not talking about Van Halen right now. We're talking about Jeff Simons.
Yes.
Ben, how was he?
Oh, he's terrific. It's a tremendous show. He had most of the Megan Schlenker band, I would say. He had
okay.
a different keyboardist and a different bassist because he's the bassist.
Okay.
Interestingly, Jeff went for basically like the front man. Like he played a little bit of keyboards and a little bit of guitar, but most of the time he was kind of doing the little Jeff Simons dance and had his arms out and was just bringing it super hard.
Jeff, how many songs did you get to play?
We did a dozen, I think. We did 10 of mine and two covers.
Ooh,
and,
what were the covers?
We did Bob Dylan's Sooner or Later, One of Us
Must
Know.
Yeah.
And then we closed with...
tell them the classic medley. I mean, one people have heard a million times.
Oh, the Kissimmee, Won't Get Fooled Again medley.
You know how when you go from Kissimmee into Won't Get Fooled Again, which is like in a different key and a different rhythm?
It's equivalent songs.
He went ahead and just like ended Kissimmee and went into Won't Get Fooled Again. And I was like, ha ha ha, he's going to do 30 seconds of this. Nope. He did the full like 6 minute Won't Get Fooled Again.
Yes. Yes.
Awesome. Yeah, the band was terrific. They really, they learned the song so well. They played really, really hard. We had an amazing crowd. We filled the Ivy Room on a Thursday night in COVID.
And it was loud and very enthusiastic. It was great.
Yeah, man, they were great. They were such a great audience. So total success. So fun. Can't wait to play again. Actually, already have received some overtures for offers to co-bill with a couple of other bands. So.
Let's go. That's great. Yeah. Who was your... So I saw the one clip. The guitarist looked like he was on fire. Who was that guy?
That's James DiPreto, my friend.
Oh, that's James. Okay, sure.
Yeah, from the Chuck Prophet and Megan Schlenker band. And just basically James DiPreto by himself, you know,
right.
Force of nature. So
the man can play guitar.
The man can play a little guitar.
I got one short critique that you will appreciate, and then I've got one piece of praise, which I believe you will also appreciate.
Okay, hit it.
The first short critique is, hey, Tim, do you remember when you and I discussed what our favorite Jeff Simons song is?
Yeah, and I was figuring, like, could that work in such a setting? Or
yeah, you know how you see your favorite band and they don't play your favorite song?
Yeah,
it's tough.
Sorry.
It's tough. No music I've forgotten.
I understand that. That
it is. It's a slower acoustic number. I get it. That would have definitely quieted the dancing down for sure.
Right.
But still, I'll just go ahead and note for the record that
you
we
didn't
got
get
no
what you,
music
you,
I forgot.
You flew out for.
The second thing I'll say, and this is a theme of this podcast, is long-term human relationships, which if it's not the richest thing in life, it's one of the richest things in life. And sometimes I will lapse into the high school Ben Barton from Brooklyn.
Yes.
I'm up there and Jeff's up there playing. And I just, in my head, I hear the voice. It's like, this fucking kid, Look at this fucking kid. I know this fucking kid for years. I know him for years. This guy, are you seeing this fucking guy? I turned to Susan's next to me. I'm like, this fucking kid, are you seeing this?
That is lovely.
It's a beautiful thing, man.
It really is.
See Jeff, like, just out there doing his thing and so brave, putting it on the line,
right?
Like, his own personal artistic expression, invites everybody who loves him and knows him, and they all turn out. It was beautiful.
I so appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I had worlds colliding so hard, old colleagues, old friends, old students, former parents. Like, it was.
Lead singer of Fishbone. These are people that come out to see Jeff play.
It was fantastic. Great. You know, I just have to say, you have not lived until you front your own band for the first time in a decade and a half, and you look down and the greatest frontman on earth is watching you like critically in the very front with his arms folded, listening really carefully.
Oh,
like
good.
Not in the back having a drink, but like checking you out. Like
he was into it though.
He was great. Angelo is the best, man.
Oh, that James, is awesome.
James and I afterwards were like, you know, any gig where Angelo Moore just mysteriously appears halfway through and then is gone. Is this the greatest gig you play? So,
well, looking at those clips, Jeff, it looked like you were having a ball. Like
a good time was had. I think a good time was had by all, man. It was
for sure.
Yeah.
People were
but
ready
don't
to rock
it. Jeff was working, man. He was super nervous beforehand and understandably so.
I just love that you're willing to put yourself out there to promote our podcast.
Yep.
That's what's really important.
Right. Yeah, I will be billing the marketing department for costs incurred.
Okay.
So, you know, band and you know, their rider, like those guys can drink a lot. So I don't know if you've seen the Blues Brothers, but
yeah. So Ben, now you and I gotta do something. We've got to put ourselves out there.
For sure.
Some sort of law lecture on a soapbox in a Knoxville park, something like that. Well, yeah, I'll do it. Well, congratulations, Jeff. I'm sorry I couldn't be there. Cannot wait for the next one because I'm definitely going to make it happen. You know why? Because look at this guy. Look at him.
This freaking guy.
This freaking guy.
That's what I'm going to call the next EP. That'll be great. Well, yeah, hey. Ben is the best. There's no, I mean, it goes without saying, any friend who will get on an airplane and fly halfway across the country to watch an hour of music is, that's dedication with a capital dedication.
It's actually all the way across the country, just to clarify for Ben's purposes. It's good
I just
stuff.
Meant that Nashville's, you know, Knoxville, Nashville, and Asheville, and Blashville, and all the places where you guys live are, you know, they're not exactly on the East Coast, but they're
fly over country, Tim. You heard him.
That's right.
Well, welcome everybody to 50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys. One of us was acting like a 28-year-old the other night.
But and we paying for it. And paying for it.
Oh, good, good.
Very
we're part of the
Drive-In
Podcast Network, so check us out wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, let's jump into 1983, is it? 1983 proper?
The big year. It was that's ninth grade, I think, 83. Or 83, 84 is my ninth grade year. Really? Yeah, yeah.
Huh, I don't think I'm there yet. So give me your favorite song from Thriller, because it is our Grammy winner and it is our best-selling album of the year. What do you got? What do you want to go with?
My favorite song from Thriller. Well, Ken, we've already played
our
a bunch of songs.
Three albums.
So let me
play your
least
favorite.
Let me showcase the ballad that I really love. Like, I'm not a ballad guy, and some of the slower songs on this record annoy the hell out of me, but I do love this song.
It's the Grammy winner. It's the number one album.
Thriller by Michael Jackson. Just an apple, then let me tell.
we better be careful about that 1 minute with Michael Jackson. I'm sure his lawyers will come after us.
Come back and get us.
That's where I end it. For me, that's where the record really ends. Like, I don't listen to Pretty Young Thing or The Lady in My Life,
right?
Like, ever. If I'm ever, I mean, the idea of actually sitting down and listening to Thriller, like, huh, I haven't heard that in a while, is actually kind of funny. But like, I hate that Paul McCartney song, but I can just go right through tracks 1 through 7 with no pain. And then that's the kind
then
of
it ends.
The last song I really love. Yeah.
And Ben Barton, you're out on the Paul McCartney song as well, right?
Oh yeah, totally. And I basically, like, that keyboard sound is tough.
Yeah.
That's a tough get right there. But I mean, throughout this record, there's spectacular guitar work. Like, as soon as the guitars come in, I'm like, oh, okay, now I remember.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so beautiful. They really separate the chords out into their constituent parts and then play them in this beautiful finger picky funk way. I mean, it's the same for the fast and the slow songs. Like, the guitar work, in my opinion, just like helps carry the record.
So this was also the year that Michael Jackson performs at the Apollo Theater, right? The Motown celebration.
Oh, is that right? And he does the moonwalk for the first time?
Unveils the moonwalk and brings the house down with that move. So since it did not come out in 1983, it is not the all-time bestseller released in 1983. That distinction goes to Lionel Richie.
Oh, awesome.
Did I tell my
Can't Slow Down? Can't Slow Down. It's another three-word title that
really
we're butchering.
It's a fact.
Do you have a Lionel Richie story for us, Ben?
I got two Lionel Richie stories.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Okay.
One is that he was like a headliner. He opened up for Jay-Z or somebody. It was awesome. It was like a 5 p.m. Saturday night main stage thing. And he was so off the hook good and hilarious. But that wasn't the first time I saw him at Bonnaroo. The first time I saw him at Bonnaroo is, we're on the fifth stage. There's five stages. This is the smallest stage. And they've got Kenny Rogers on this stage.
Okay.
And so it's not a huge turnout amongst the Bonnaroo faithful, unless you want to include all of the civic leaders of Manchester, Tennessee, which is where Bonnaroo is located.
Outstanding.
So this is not a joke. The mayor of Manchester comes out and gives him a key to the city, and the whole city council's there. And they're like, we love you. You're the greatest, Kenny. You're awesome. And I mean, so Kenny Rogers is an elderly man when he was a big hit. He's a super elderly man by this point. And he's like, okay, well, thanks, fellas. Sure. He's just so confused by the whole thing. Anyhow, then they shuffle off the city leaders. And he's like, just as a treat, I thought I'd bring my friend in. Brings Lionel Richie out. And Jeff, what's the name of the stupid song that they do together?
Oh, I have no idea. They did a song together?
There's a Lionel Richie,
I'm looking
Kenny
it up.
Kenny Rogers song. They do that song, and then Kenny Rogers is like, and Lionel's got one more for you, and he does All Night Long. And I mean, I lost my shit. Like, I was just like completely out of my mind singing along. And I mean, basically, I never bought that record. I don't even really care for it that much, but that song is just so great. So great.
Oh my God, it's Lady. They did Lady together.
Oh,
Lady.
That makes sense. They both sang that for a hit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
for
my
sure.
God.
Yeah, I was at another show and someone was like, Lionel Richie is going to sing Lady with Kenny Rock. Because I know that some of the promoters, they're like, you got to see this. And I was like, oh, I do indeed need to
Let
see
me go
that.
Right
that is
now.
The thing that I need to see.
All right. Well, let's move on with 1983. I will come back to a musical moment in 1983, Jeff Simons, that you will enjoy.
Okay.
All right. Let's hit some facts. Final episode of MASH.
Oh.
Three. Is it still like the largest episode audience ever?
I feel like we talked about this last time because I remember recently expressing my irritation at the last episode of MASH.
Okay.
But maybe we did. I don't remember.
Maybe it was the last episode of our podcast. I don't know.
Like, I think when we did 83 before, we talked about the last episode of MASH.
All right. Samantha Smith is invited to Russia by Yuri Andropov. Do you remember this?
No. I don't know who Samantha Smith is.
11-year-old girl from Maine who writes a letter to Russia's premier saying, I'm worried about nuclear war, and Reagan was ticked because Samantha Smith was being used as a tool by the Russians. I remember just being jealous that I wanted to go.
I forgot all about Yuri Andropov.
Still a tool of the Russians to me.
Yes. We've talked about the Tamil Tigers on our podcast before. It's in 1983 that the Tamil Tigers ambush a Sri Lankan army unit, and thus the civil war, which goes from 1983 to 2009, begins.
Oh. By the way, Tamil.
Gosh, dang it. Did I do that last time too?
Yeah, it's all right though.
There's a lot to cut. In this
what famous current artist speaks Tamil as her first language?
Well, you mean not the one Ben picked?
The one Ben picked.
Yeah. Oh,
right. MIA.
Well, there's two actually. MIA and then Aziz Ansari is also Tamil.
That's right.
Not Tamil.
A captain and Tamil. I believe that's pronounced.
That is the musical act I was thinking of. Thank you.
That'd be pretty good if you took the captain and Tamil and connected it with MIA, put some gunshots on Muskrat Love and slowed that shit down. It'd be pretty good.
The first Swatch models debut in 1983. Did either of you have a Swatch?
I did not.
Oh, I had a Swatch, and it's actually it's one of those really horrible high school stories.
Okay. Oh, no.
I had a Swatch, and I showed up at Middle High School with my Swatch, and there was like a bunch of discussion at the lunchtime where they were like, that's sort of a cool watch. What's the story? And I was like, it's Swatch. It's a Swiss watch. And they were like, what's good about it? I was like, well, it's waterproof. It's like indestructible. I mean, basically, it's made of things that can't be broken. And my buddy was like, I bet I could break it. And I was like, no, it's shatterproof. You can't break it. And he just put his elbow on it and broke it. And I was like, well, that'll be it for that. That was awesome.
That was a quick story.
So I had my Swatch for like a week and a half. And then I brought it home to my parents and I was like, it broke. And they were like, dude.
Did either of you, speaking of the 80s and fashion, either of you have a members only jacket?
I did not. 80s. I was pretty horrendously untrendy.
Ornery?
No, just poor. Just no money to do those things. And if I had money, I was buying records with it. But I had a pair of Ocean Pacific shorts that I'm sure would be pornographic in the modern era. I mean, I think they were so short, but I had those. But I think that's the closest thing I got to relevance.
My family was fashionable, but only when the knockoff products arrived at Zaire.
That's what I'm talking about.
And then we would get like the member only jacket.
Right, know, members so, with a Z.
Yeah, something like that.
That's awesome.
All right. Return of the Jedi comes out. What was your impression of Return of the Jedi back in the day? Not now, not in retrospect.
I didn't like the Ewoks the moment I saw the movie, and I really hated the Yum Yum song at the end, but I loved it. Are you kidding? Like, Hanchett and I went opening day and stood in a giant line in a crazy crowd, it blew my ass away. But I did think the Ewoks were unnecessarily adorable.
I also think now
appearance.
That we're in the fullness of time, Timmy.
Yes. Yes.
So of the original trilogy, it's the worst. I mean, it's fair to say that. And I put it Empire, Star Wars, and that one the last.
1,000% agree.
But then as soon as you see them try and make other ones, you're like, that's awesome. Yeah. So good. It was really good.
Yeah.
Like, the thing that's crazy about Empire is that it's better than Star Wars. You know how hard it is? It's like Godfather 2. You know how hard it is to make a movie that's better than the original when the original is a gargantuan hit? So I wasn't surprised. I mean, what are the odds they were going to make a third one which is better than the second one? Like, that struck me as pretty unlikely.
Right.
But that being said, it's great. It's fantastic. It's got a bunch of really entertaining parts. Especially, I mean, as soon as you get to the prequels, you're like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Totally. I tell you, I was disappointed that Darth Vader comes out okay. I wanted the man dead. I'll say it.
Wow.
He did die. And that is the original one.
I wanted Luke to kill him.
Anakin came back.
Luke puts down his lightsabers. Like,
you didn't like it when he threw the Emperor down the well? That didn't, your bloodlust was not satisfied?
No,
perhaps you wanted to see some Ewoks go down with the Emperor.
I don't know this Emperor.
There were definitely not
By all the way, I know is Darth Vader. Darth Vader killed Obi-Wan.
There were not enough dead Ewoks. That really would have brought some gravitas.
That was funny. The Ewoks were banging on the Empire machinery, and how funny would it be that just like the 35 dead Ewoks piled underneath the AT-AT walker, just totally. Like squish, squish, squish.
Totally like a Schindler's List of Ewok bodies.
Oh God! All right, moving on.
I got out of hand quick.
So
that's why we're not film critics. Oh God.
All right. Yeah. Getting back to 1983, Sports comes out. Huey Lewis and the News release Sports. And for me, that was a gigantic, I mean, I know Thriller is there, dominating everything, but Sports comes out, and how many top 40 hits does Sports have?
I don't know. You know, I never remember where songs end up charting, but it had Heart of Rock and Roll was a top 10 hit. Heart and Soul was a top 10 hit. I Want a New Drug was a top 10 hit.
And that was the first single in Gigantic.
Yeah. And If This Is It was a top 10 hit. Now, that's four at least. And then like Walking on a Thin Line and Bad is Bad definitely got played on the radio also.
Bad is Bad. So, I got MTV play.
Yep.
All right. Give me 30 seconds of your favorite Huey Lewis and the News song from Sports.
From Sports, because my favorite song by him is Working for a Living, and it's not even close. I think that's one of the greatest songs ever made. I'll go with Heart and Soul. I think it's great.
Ben, is that a keyboard that's irritating you right now?
I love that call and response with his own voice. Hectic, hectic. Have I told the Sports story on this podcast?
I don't think so. No, we haven't mentioned Huey Lewis.
All right, so humble brag alert. Huey is as somebody I actually know a little bit. I've played with Huey, and Huey has sat in with bands that I play with, and I've known him for a really long time. And he is one of the most genuine, friendly guys you will ever meet.
He is
unpretentious to the point of being like hilariously unpretentious.
Okay.
Like he just like never, he is more likely to make fun of his own work than anybody I've ever met who's even remotely successful. But his great sport, the story he told us about Sports was they deliver the record to the record company, and the A&R guy brings him in. He says, look, I have a question. Do you want to sell 2 million records or 20 million records? And they all laugh. And he's like, no. I'm asking a serious question. This is a great record. This is a great rock and roll record, and it will sell at least 2 million copies. Do you want to be the biggest band in the world and sell 20 million records and make it a pop record? And they all look at each other and like, well, duh. And he's like, then you have to let me wipe the drum tracks and replace them with electronic drums.
Whoa.
Like I have to take the rock drums off, which makes it sound like a Tom Petty record, and put the digital drums of the moment on there, which is going to make it sound like a pop record. And he turned to the drummer. He's like, if you're willing to eat that crow, not that you didn't play fantastically, but you're not a computer. If you make that switch, then this record's going to go through the ceiling. And they look at each other and like, all right, do it. Boom. And that's the difference between why Picture This sells 1 million and this one sells 14 million. That is not the original drum track. It is a programmed Lin drum machine replacing everything the drummer did because the whole record was recorded to a click track anyway, which is why live they sounded like a rock band and they never quite sound that way on the radio. But
that is fascinating.
And I asked like, well, you know, how did that go over? And he's like, well, next time you hang out with my drummer, ask him how he likes his boat.
He was able to eat it. Yeah. Yep.
Somehow he found a way.
That's good.
Yeah, I saw Huey Lewis in the News for the first time on this tour while they were in ascendance. It was before that it all exploded. They were the opening act for 38 Special. Remember that Southern rock band?
Oh, yeah.
But they just, they came out and killed it. They had a 70-minute show that was just watertight, just fantastic.
Good. So. All right. Well, before we get to our three albums, let's see who died in 1983. I will go ahead and say a word. As soon as you have a guess, start guessing. Dead person number one, football. Hat.
Tom Landry.
Bear Bryant.
Alabama. Bear Bryant is correct.
That's one right. Tom Landry lives for a much longer
That's
time.
That's amazing.
1-0 Ben Barton. Playwright. Brick.
Arthur Miller.
Stella.
Arthur Miller. Oh, Tennessee Williams.
Tennessee Williams dies in 1983.
Brick was a really good second word.
Thank
Jim.
You. Thank you.
That was well done.
All right, last one for all the marbles. Boxer, old, white.
Rocky Marciano.
Older.
Shoot, I'm out.
1920s.
Oh, what's the name of that guy?
Yeah, I know, Gene Tunney. Who's the bare knuckle?
No, he
lunatic?
Beat Tunney. He whipped up on Tunney.
He's the best heavyweight boxer of the 1920s.
He's the highest paid athlete in the 20s. He earned 5 times the amount that Babe Ruth did.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there's a famous contract case that I teach, and I've just forgotten the name of the dude.
Oh, Jack Dempsey.
Oh, of
course. Jack Dempsey.
That's embarrassing for us. Sorry, Jim.
Samola.
Born in 1895, dies in 1983.
So how do these guys not kill each other fighting bare knuckled for 106 rounds? Are they just not strong enough to do the damage? Because if Mike Tyson hit a guy with his bare fist for 50 rounds, that man is not getting up. Like, how do they keep from like just ruining each other?
Hold on. It's self-selected. Like,
yeah.
Dempsey's like, so the Dempsey story is his parents convert to Mormonism and move to Utah.
Oh, wow.
When he's 16, he and his brother run away from home and they make their living fighting bare knuckled brawls in bars.
Jesus,
where the brother comes in and says, I'll take $100 from any man that could whip my brother. And they gather all the money and then Dempsey comes in and beats people senseless. And then, so it's self-selecting. Like, you didn't get to be a professional boxer unless you survived the circuit.
Yeah.
And the circuit was so bruising and hard. I mean, Lord knows what happened to the people who Dempsey beat.
Yeah.
But he made it out of the circuit and then he built his way up. And dude, I mean, he played, he boxed to 110,000 people. At
wow. Good
without,
Lord.
Without, like, with like lights and like
yeah,
little
right,
ants
right.
fighting yeah. there. It's insane.
Apparently he just had a devastating right hand as well. Like,
yeah.
Guys didn't last. Guys didn't get shots in.
Yeah, no, his first title fight was against a 6'9" guy and he broke his jaw and his ribs and like the guy didn't make it out of the first round. The guy outweighed Dempsey by 50 pounds and had to reach another foot and a half beyond Dempsey's and Dempsey just murdered him.
God, it's terrifying. All right. Let's get to our three albums.
I just have to say, thank God education actually means something
oh,
in
right.
this country. I'm just imagining what role I would play in society if Jack Dempsey was in charge. I mean, I would just be like the guy who carries the bucket of spit around for him.
If if glasses weren't invented, like what would I have done in the 1300s? I would have just been walking into trees. It would have been terrible. All right. Who gets to go first? I can't remember. We're behind in our schedule, so
I think it's me. I get to go first.
Yeah, let's do it.
Our three albums.
I badly wanted to do Pretenders Learning to Crawl.
Okay.
I looked hard at Rebel Yell, Pyromania, and then actually I believe in the year 1983, my favorite album was The Fix, Reach the Beach.
Oh, that's
which I was super into.
Quality.
But
shit.
There's one record that I've listened to more than any other record. And I'm going to defer to Jeff to give me a little background on where our guy David Bowie finds himself in 1982. Because Jeff will know.
Fantastic. David Bowie, as we all know, is one of the most influential artists in rock history, and one of the most interesting for all of these moments of recreation, right? He's this wide-eyed he's a soul singer first in the 60s, and those go nowhere. Then he becomes this kind of wide-eyed hippie that last couple of years. Then he becomes a bisexual outer space rock god. Then he loses the weight he doesn't have and becomes a rail thin cocaine addict that's called the Thin White Duke. But by 1983, Bowie's kind of run his course. 1980s Scary Monsters has a few minor hits, but he's starting to exist on the fringes of pop culture. He's not having a consistent series of big hits. There's even mild talk of retirement. And, he's really finding himself lumped in with groups on the downside of their trajectory and not given much of a chance to be relevant in the 80s. And then we get to 1983.
It's really fun. Like, I would strongly recommend you go back and just do the David Bowie discography. Like, the stuff that comes out between 1980 and 1983, you're like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Like, there's like weird. Some weird soundtrack stuff. And then there's a classical record where he reads something mumbling over on top of a classical record.
Peter and the Wolf. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, God. It's super. I mean, it's like, for a guy who's taken a lot of weird turns in his career, it's super weird. And you would be extra forgiven for thinking that this guy is completely done. He bailed out on his record company, signs a new record deal. And for the, and actually, Jeff, remind me, I can't remember which one of these 70s ones is, there's a favorite stretch of Bowie that you love.
Yeah, it's mid 70s. I love the Station to Station, that kind of 676, 77. There's a live record stage in 78 where the band is just unbelievable. It's like Adrian Belew, who, you know, I have I'll Ride or Die For, yes. A bunch of other amazing players. It's so cool and weird and interesting. And then there's some stuff I don't love as much, like Lodger and Scary Monsters, but he's still
You don't love those, Jeff? That didn't happen for you?
I mean, there's some great songs, but no, not all the way
those
through.
Those records are no good. Dude, so no, come Jeff on. Has
Fashion's
continuously
great,
been trying to sell me
and,
on this.
And DJ I'll just is great.
Say, I'll just go ahead and say for the, like, I had a buddy in high school who was a huge Bowie guy, and he would just be heartbroken to find out that I'm going to choose Wet Stance, which he can consider to be just apostasy. For him, it would be like, you know, choosing Born in the USA as your favorite Springsteen record or whatever.
Or 5150 is your favorite Van Halen
record.
Oh, yeah.
Would be heartbroken over it. And I'm just going to go ahead and recognize this is not the hipster Bowie pick, but all those hipster can kiss my ass. This record's amazing.
Love it.
My favorite Coen Brothers movies are the ones where they try and make good movies. That's my favorite ones.
Okay.
Like Raising Arizona. That's my absolute favorite.
Mine too.
But like these are guys who are capable of making unbelievably entertaining movies, and then they just like basically choose to be a little bit more artistically daring and other things. Same thing with Bowie. He's tired of being nobody. He's tired of being off on the woods doing weird stuff. He's like, you know what I want to do in 1983 with my brand new record contract is I want to sell a jillion records. He goes ahead and signs up with Nile Rodgers from Chic, which is just it appears obvious in retrospect, but at the time it's kind of a loopy move. Like, disco's over. Chic is like on the very deep fumes of like, if you look at the Chic discography, they put out 7 albums. And there's 4 Chic songs that the people, anyone can sing. Like, they're still putting out albums in 1983. He did the Diana Ross record with I'm Coming Out on it. He did Sister Sledge, We Are Family. Like, but all of these are disco songs. There's no reason at all why David Bowie should hire this guy to produce this record and create the entire sound. Bowie's like, I dig you. So he and Nile Rodgers go into the studio. They record an entire record And it's basically with the Chic band plus some extra A++ studio guys. The studio guys that they get on this record are so freaking fantastic. It's Carmine Rojas is the bass guitarist. This is his first album, Jeff. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Wow.
He gets sucked. Wow. Like, basically, now Rogers has found him. He's like, this is my guy. They bring him in. Omar Hakim on drums or Tony Thompson on drums. Pick your poison. Either one of them are just unbelievably awesome. Now Rogers in and of himself is a really good guitar player. Like, just a terrific, terrific, terrific rhythm guitar player. They got the entire record in the can. Bowie's at the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland, and he sees a weird trio from Austin, Texas, who get booed off the stage.
Oh, no.
Booed off the stage for playing an electric set, and it would be Stevie Ray Vaughan in Double Trouble. Bowie's
before,
so
before the record comes out, before Texas Flood is released.
Before they've even recorded the record. Dude, he gets the recording deal because Jackson Browne sees him as like, this guy's fantastic, and they sign him up.
Yeah. Wow.
Bowie finds him at the bar afterwards. It's like, I loved your set. Will you come and play on my album? And first of all, if you've ever heard Stevie Ray Vaughan interviewed, you know that Stevie Ray Vaughan's like, sure. And he's like, really? You want to come to New York and play at the Power Station? And Stevie Ray Vaughan's like, and you can go back and look at the interviews. They're hilarious. He's like, I've never left Texas. Like, it's my life savings to fly to Montreux and get booed off the stage. David Bowie wants you to record in New York. Sure, man.
Yeah,
that sounds great. They bring him up to New York and he plays all the lead guitar parts on the record. And it's like this weird bit of alchemy. Like, you've got three really, really, really weird acts all piled on top of each other. You got David Bowie, who's decided to become a massive pop sensation. And he hires a has-been, and no shade to Nile Rodgers at all. He goes on to have a spectacular career. He had a great career before. He's the freaking created hip hop. Right. I mean, the backtrack to hip hop is his bass lines and his songs. But at this point, he's kind of washed up. And then they bring in Stevie Ray Vaughan. It works out incredibly. The three hit songs off this record are among my favorite three songs ever. And it goes bang, bang, bang. The side A of this record are the four singles from the record.
Okay.
And then side B of the record, and I'll be super curious to hear Jeff's thoughts. Side B is an actual David Bowie record.
Yes.
Like, side B is really weird. It's got a bunch of weird stuff on it.
Weird as hell.
If you're into, like, basically, if you like Stevie Ray, then you kind of want to listen to side B, because, like, Cat People, parentheses, Putting Out Fire.
With gasoline, I believe is how the rest of that line goes.
That's the one that's got the most Stevie Ray on it.
It's also really the soundtrack song to a Nastassja Kinski movie.
Oh, right. Directed by Giorgio Moroder.
That's correct. Is
like, yeah, so good. So good. Anyhow, track one, Modern Love. Track two, China Girl. And I don't even care that it's called China Girl. That song is great.
It is a great song.
And then Let's Dance. Unbelievable. I'm going to ask Jeff for some forbearance. Rather than do one song, just give me the first 30 seconds of Modern Love and the first 30 seconds of Let's Dance. For Modern Love, I want you to get all the way through the mumbling. The you mumbling that starts that song.
It kills me.
It's the greatest. Here we go. Modern Love.
Oh, wait, hold on. Sorry. Oh,
yeah.
And listen to these guitar parts, man. Like, the solos are Stevie Ray, but the guitar parts by Niles Rogers are so, so good. And the Omar Hakim drumming. It's like, oh, and actually, I meant to say this when you said about the drum machine. This is a band. This is an example of how great live drums are, how fantastic they are. Bowie could have gone with a drum machine, and I'm sure that some executive did. And he was like, no, dude, you got to hear Omar Hakim play drums. Like, it sounds so great. 30 seconds Modern Love, 30 seconds Let's Dance.
Done.
Let's Dance by David Bowie.
Do you hear that?
I thought it came right away.
I know when to go out. I know when to stay in. Get things done.
Catch the paper boy, but things don't really change. I'm
great.
Talk about how outrageous that first vocal line is in Let's Dance. Like he comes in all mumbly as like put on. It sounds like somebody doing a Dracula impression.
Put on your red shoes and dance.
It's so great. And then
oh, it's amazing.
How cool do you have to be to mumble on the start of your comeback record?
Dude.
Right.
I don't want to go out.
Let alone the modern love. I don't want to go out. What's going on?
That's what I'm talking about. It's so great. It's makes you lean in. You're like, what? What did he say? I remember the first time I heard this, he's like, and get things done. I'm like, what is going on?
Hey,
now I
Jeff,
love it.
In case you're wondering whether Let's Dance is at least 50% Nile Rodgers, there's four Chic songs.
Yeah.
That I knew before I got to the greatest hits. Can you name them?
La Freak.
Sure.
I Want Your Love. Good Times. And come on. What's the other huge hit?
Wait, there's two more that feature the word dance.
Oh, right. Dance, Dance, Dance. And
Everybody Dance.
Everybody
the
first
Dance. Two songs of the greatest hits are Dance, 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 parentheses. And Jeff will know the parentheses.
No, I don't. I can't remember.
Yowza, yowza,
oh, yowza, yowza.
I strongly recommend you go back and listen to the song. It's freaking hilarious. It's a disco song where they're like, dance, dance, everybody dance, dance is amazing. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, presumably some weird white Jewish guy's like, yowza, 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 on top of it. Okay. Anyhow, I love it that at some point Bowie and Rodgers are like, you know, getting together, and Bowie's like, I love your material. And I was like, what'd you like? And he's like, I love Dance Dance and I love Everybody Dance. And now Rodgers is like, how about Let's Dance?
Yep.
Bowie's like, let's do it.
Let's dance indeed. Yep. Awesome.
Anyhow, I understand that this is not a cool Bowie pick. I understand that I'm choosing his most popular record. I just don't care. Y'all can kiss my butt. This record is so great. Those three songs in a row, like just pop majesty. Like, and you compare him, and it's not to just bury Rod Stewart again, but, or let alone, I mean, there's a Nile Rodgers, Mick Jagger record, and you know, I'm a huge Stones guy. That record's a disaster.
Yeah.
Like they somehow managed to like poison it, but Bowie did the opposite. Like he was just like, he really, really hit the sweet spot. And these songs are not cheesy pop songs, in my opinion. Like
no.
He brings a Bowie sensibility.
I agree.
To it,
yeah.
But he flips it over.
Yep.
And it's like this great dance music, super fun.
Right.
Dude, if I play like most 1983 hits that I would play to my daughters, they would just have no, they would be like, oh, I don't
stop.
Like, really? This is the opposite. These songs from when Dolly had ears, I was like, you're gonna like this. And she was like, I do like it. Just Let's Dance and Modern Love are all timers. I consider them to be like Shakespeare level art. Like
yeah.
I would imagine that in 100 years, people are going to be like, wow, Let's Dance. I do like dancing.
Yeah.
Modern Love kills me. Like the how he ends it too. Like we talk about the beginning of the song, the ending of the song is just awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, I mean, and I don't know from unless you were really precocious, if you're 12 years old, 13 years old in 1983, this is your Bowie introduction.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Oh,
you know, and it was I mean, I knew the song Space Oddity. I knew that song, and I probably knew like one of the punkier ones because by 1983, I was listening to punk rock. And so stuff from Ziggy Stardust was probably in my world. But this was the first one where like I just knew these songs. I know these songs by heart. Those first three songs, there's not a little anything involved in any of those songs that I don't know immediately. And I think Let's Dance is a class. I always have. I always thought Let's Dance was underrated for how big a hit it was. It's just fantastic, man.
Yeah, man. And like the side B is super weird and interesting. Like the whole thing, I re-listened to it all multiple times over the week. And I was like, man, I'm kind of digging this. It was actually a good argument for the CD. So when the album came out, I bought the album.
And just worked side one into the ground.
It was side one. And then I was like, well, you know, I don't really flip it over too often. It's working out for me. But then I bought the CD in college when I was collecting, like building up my CD collection. And I was like, oh, like there's some neat stuff on side B.
Oh, that's really cool.
Well done.
All right, Jeff. What do you got?
Well, I've been picking a lot of obscure stuff. Right. I mean, I've been looking at my stupid self-imposed rules have brought in hopefully some new music for some of our friends listening. But I am on a really pretty obscure run here. So I am jumping back into the mainstream.
Yeah. The mayor of Knoxville. Thanks you.
Is that right?
Yeah.
She's ready for me to stop talking about bands that no one cares about. A lot of people care about this band. Including me, and like anybody our age who loves music, you have some kind of relationship with this band if you're a rock and roll fan. This is not my favorite record by this band, but I'm picking the debut because it allows me to talk about some other records I like a little bit more in later years, but because this is such an audacious debut record. It belongs on the short list of greatest first records of all time. And it's one of those rare debuts where the band introduces itself fully formed. A lot of debut records, you can hear what they might become. You're like, oh, wow, that's really cool. And that part's really neat. But they're just playing it's the first 12 songs they wrote together. And like, there's some good stuff and some weird stuff. And this band's whole thing, I feel like it just like, whew, it's there. It's a miracle of teamwork. And I think ultimately this band's defined by its teamwork. If there was ever a band where the sum is greater than the individual parts, it's REM. And their first record,
Murmur,
is 1983. And I'm going to be totally transparent and say it took me so long to love Murmur compared to other REM records. The first record I owned by REM was the second one, Reckoning. And I loved it right away. Then I bought Fables, which is the third record, and didn't like it as much. It was slower. It was muddier. It was more. And I got to say, like, REM was a band I liked but didn't love until Life's Rich Pageant came out. And that record put me just completely off the deep end. I fell for them incredibly hard, went and saw them like, you know, a million times. But I got a cassette tape from my friend Mike, which had Murmur on one side and New Gold Dream by Simple Minds on the other. So the first problem is, did not like New Gold Dream. So to listen to Murmur, I had to listen to it and then waste battery rewinding to get back to the middle of Murmur. But it felt a little slow.
Hey man, what's on New Gold Dream? Is there a song in there I would know?
No, it's like their first big European hit. It's not even the one with Up on the Catwalk on it. Like, it's really a deep dive. Like, no, it doesn't. I mean, there's not a single song. I can't even remember a song on it, to be honest. But this record at first sounded like the cover. Like, the cover of Murmur is kudzu, like growing up and over a kind of a Georgian swampy landscape. And I wanted the mix to be scrubbed a little clean at first. Like, it felt a little murky. It felt a little, you know, the lyrics, the vocals buried, and you can't really understand what he's singing. And it's not in a hurry. It's not a record that's super propulsive, and it's not a punk rock record. But at the same time, it has all the like punk rock elements that I love. It's got a remarkable DIY quality. There are very few overdubs that aren't kind of sonic and deep in the background. They're kids playing at the absolute edge of their ability, right? I mean, this record is as good as these guys can do in 1983 and nothing more. And the songs, they're so rich, like everything's so well thought out. These guys leave so much space for one another. Like, there's just moments where Mike Mills's bass parts are just beautiful, and you know, like Radio Free Europe, the bass is the lead instrument. It's not even close. And like, there are moments when all that great Rickenbacker 12 string finger picking that Peter Buck does is in the front, and Stipe has moments where he lets his voice be beautiful, and Bill Berry through the whole thing plays such propulsive, restrained drums. Murmur is such a great example of why there are bands and why this moment where a guy like me can make a whole record by itself is both amazing and a terrible idea, right? Because bouncing your talents off of other people who have different complementary talents is the sweet spot. Ben started this podcast by saying like long time friendship and communication leads to transcendence and genius. And REM is an example of that. This band broke up and they are still best friends and they understand each other and their catalog, even if you fall out of love with them the way that I did, like there's a REM Mach 1 and an REM Mach 2 and part 2 of this band breaks my heart because I want to love it and I don't. But Murmur is the beginning of a love affair for me that goes through their first 5 or 6 records. I just cannot recommend enough both letting the whole record play. Ben just talked about the beauty, right?
Right.
This is not a skip around, pick your favorite. Like, let all 40 minutes of Murmur wash over you. It's a journey into a space. And it's just such a beautiful example of friendship. Like, 4 kids from Athens, Georgia, all they want to do is play a little club together, and they accidentally conquer the world, and they do it without really remarkably changing what made them great. I mean, when Bill leaves the band for his health in 94, things really do change. But up until that point, this is a group of guys who are willing to come to the table and make art together. I don't know how to pick a song. I will pick the song that almost broke the band up. So Murmur's recorded in North Carolina with a guy named Mitch Easter, who does a brilliant job shepherding this band through. He's an indie rock producer. He did the DBs. His own band, Let's Active, made some really good music. But he makes the EP for REM that came out in 82, and it gets them a major label deal. And they go to New York with a famous producer, and he makes them record the song Catapult 100 times. Because they can't get it to the click. He's like, you guys got to learn how to be a real professional band, and you're loose and you're sloppy. They record 100 takes of Catapult, each one less soulful than the other. And they decide they're going to quit. They're like, I don't want to do this. Oh, we're not a real band. And they run back to North Carolina. And Mitch is like, look, just come play with me. Just like, remember what you are. And he turns the click track off and they record the whole record. And IRS Records is like, well, this gets you major label distribution. This is great. And they survive the moment with major label idiocy that could have broke them up.
Wait, what's a click track?
That's where you have a computer going in your ears and you play along to it so that the record doesn't speed up. So it doesn't speed up and slow down and you have a consistent groove through it. It allows you to edit tracks together. Like, I like the first minute of take 1 and the best part of take 2, right? It allows a guy like me to record all the guitars and drums, guitars and bass and piano first, and then go back and play drums over it.
Huh.
Right. Like, but it also, if you use it, if you're too married to it, it takes all the soul out of music.
Right. Yeah. Your computer.
Anyway, so here on a record with Radio Free Europe, Pilgrimage, Talk About the Passion, Perfect Circle, Sitting Still, Shaking Through. This is the song that almost broke them, and that when they went back and did it their way reveals everything this band is and will become over the next 6 years. The first song on side 2, this is Catapult from REM's Murmur.
Murmur by REM.
Good stuff.
you know, Ben always talks about parts. Listen to parts. Like, the bass line's so clever. The guitar part's so beautiful. There's three or four little distinct things. The drums are so careful. But can you imagine playing that bass intro 100 times over and over and over again with the producers like saying, nope. You know, too loose, too loose, too loose. I can't believe they survived that. But anyway, I have a big famous band with a big famous record for my 1983 pick. Back into the weeds next year, but there you go, India.
Awesome.
By the way, when they come into the chorus with the second catapult, when the band comes in, it's so funny.
Yeah, it's great.
Such a great joke.
Yeah,
like their lyrics are, especially in this period, are really inscrutable. And so, what the hell that song is about, I have no idea. But then when they come in with catapult, like as if it's Let's Dance or I Want to Love You, you're like, as if it's a word that means something. It's like catapult. I'm like, what is going on?
I love that. This is a great mumble record too. And like 9-9 starts with him just talking.
Everything mumbles. Yeah. The guitar sounds yep. mumbled. The bass sounds mumbled. It's a mumbly vibe for sure.
Yep.
But you're right. I mean, the guitar part, like that guy's great. That guitar, like it's a trio. And they really, really, really fill that space. It's beautiful.
Wow. Good stuff. Yay. Good stuff. Yeah, let's move on. We'll put this puppy to bed. I've got 1983. I had a Murmur. I had Punch the Clock with Elvis Costello.
Oh, it's good. That's an underrated Elvis Costello record. It. Punch the Clock would have been a great choice.
Speaking in Tongues by Talking Heads, Billy Bragg's album. But you know what?
Ooh.
After all that, I've got a story to tell you, and that'll be the album. I'm in college in 1988, and I'm at the University of Dayton. And there was a bar called Al's, and Al's had a drink and drown night on Wednesday nights where you'd go and you'd pay like $3.50 and then you could drink all the beer from the tap that you'd wanted. It was not Sam Adams coming from the tap. Anywho, they also had a DJ on drink and drown night. And there was a girl, don't know her name, freshman at the University of Dayton. And I asked her to dance. And this song by New Order came on. And I got danced under a table to the point where all my friends made fun of me, even though I am a good dancer. Jeff Simons, you've seen me dance.
I have.
I'm a good dancer.
Unquestionably.
Ben, are you a good dancer?
Ben's a great dancer.
You lost me at New Order, man. Just you don't want to talk to me at all now.
All right. Age of Consent, Jeff Simons.
Wow.
Power, Corruption, and Lies by New Order.
She could spin effortlessly and would just spin like in my grill. And I
have this image of you like giving up after 2.5 minutes and just like bouncing up and down until you basically had to stop and like catch your breath and lean against the wall.
The guys were like pointing and laughing. It was terrible. But anyways, I love that song.
You're going with Power, Corruption, and Lies from 1983. All right.
Ben, do you like the Smiths?
No.
What about The Cure?
No.
Jesus and Mary Chain?
Nope. This entire genre is lost to me.
So we've just lost our British audience. I can't believe this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I I don't dislike New Order the way Ben does, and I actually I don't mind this pick at all. This is a hipster pick, and like those guitars are kind of cool, and Ben loves LCD Sound System and doesn't like New Order, and he's gonna have to. He's got to answer for that a little bit. And if he doesn't pretend he didn't dance like his life depended on it to Bizarre Love Triangle all the way through college, he's a lying mofo.
I really don't like that song. I did dance to it, but I don't like it.
Yeah, man.
I don't enjoy dancing.
In the middle, and they turned on the strobe light.
Honestly, this song is better. This has instruments and stuff. This is not a keyboard song. So that's
yeah.
Better.
Yeah,
the New Order record that has really grown on me in ways that surprised me is the one that comes after this, I think. I can't remember the name of it, but there's one New Order record like in my adult life where I'm like, you know what, that record? Oh, it's Brotherhood or Low Life. I can't remember which one of those two it is, but one of those is not bad at all. And I didn't really rediscover it until about 10 years ago. But
Ben, you know who I don't like out of this genre, and they kind of ruined the whole genre in a way, is
Depeche Mode. That was my entree to this genre, and it really crushed me.
Yeah, that'll do it. I'm out of Depeche Mode, yeah.
And I have since come around to some Smith songs and some Cure songs.
Yeah, right.
I have not come around to much Depeche Mode, and just to
dude,
be frank,
I'm sorry, but that reach out and that what's the Personal Jesus? That song is fantastic. I don't care what anybody says. You're my own bird. When that comes on the radio, turn it up. And just pretend like you're the Depeche Mode dude, and you will feel like a god. Singing along to that song is so unbelievably fun. Reach out and touch me. I mean,
I've heard this story a bunch of times. But I mean, when we were in college, we were both in various bands. And then Jeff and I were together in an all-star band. These three dudes are like, we're forming our own band. And I'm like, oh, that's great. What are you going to do? And they're like, we're a Depeche Mode cover band. And I was like, really? And they were like, yeah, we're going to be a Depeche Mode cover band. And I was like, you know, it's like, it's all keyboards and synthesizers and computers. How are you going to do that? And they were like, oh, it'll be good. So they have their first gig. And I think my band was on the same bill. So I was physically there. And I was like, I can't wait to hear this. I mean, these guys are going to be terrible. Timmy, it was the exact opposite.
Their
computers and keyboards, they just programmed it to be Depeche Mode. And it was a note for note reproduction.
Three guys sitting behind keyboards.
That's how easy it is to be Depeche Mode. Three random dudes could just be like, press play, and then they sang along.
And then they sang along.
Oh, dude, it was incredible.
This is
and
karaoke.
It really made me hate Depeche Mode a lot more. A lot more.
I had the opposite reaction. It was so good. I was shaken. I was like, I'm going to go up after this and play like warbly covers of other stuff while they sounded exact. It was that I just can't get enough. Remember they had everything. They had all the little background parts. I was just and then they were motionless. They were like like the tallest guy was 5'4". It was just like three little dudes behind a rack of keyboards. Like you could barely see the guy singing, but the noise was perfect. It was epic. It was great. That was one of the funniest nights of college. That's so great.
All right. Well, we have a task before us. I forgot to tell you about this. The Jamcast podcast out of Ireland, our buddies Jono and Mark have asked us to do their next intro to their next podcast. So, Ben, what do you have to say to the folks in Ireland?
Timmy, please cut this. You can't spring this on me, brother.
Sorry, let me go to Jeff. Jeff, what do you have to say to the people of Ireland?
People of Ireland, have you made the right choice with your podcast time, because the Jamcast is without question one of the finest, most entertaining, hilarious 40 minutes you'll spend.
Oh, he's like a professional, man. What happened to you?
I love to sell. I love to sell.
But Timmy, listen, I need preparation.
All right, well... Jamcast, Jono, Mark, hope you guys are well. Have a great podcast. The guys from 50 Years of Music, send our love.
You checked that they're not like a white power podcast before we did this, right? You're not getting us in trouble.
Hold on. Let me write a quick note to myself.
Yeah, you're going to use this? You're going to use my not being able to do it? The people in Ireland are going to come here and murder me.
I think it will actually also be our bump. It'll work out twice. Just kidding. Just kidding, Ben. We're gonna edit it to make you sound super smart.
That's really good luck with that. That means you're gonna edit me out. That's the best we can do.
All right, fellas.
Timmy!
Solid work as always, my friends.
I will see you in 1984.
Can't wait.
All right, be well, my friends. Bye.
Later.
Hey, if you're having as much fun as we are, leave us a review on iTunes. Give us a rating on Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a shout. And then check us out on Twitter or at our Facebook page, 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys.
Are you a fan of classic cinema or a young person who wants to discover the best films of all time? Do these legendary movies still hold up?
On the Generation Film Podcast, two guys who grew up when movies dominated the culture share a great film with a panel of young movie lovers and see how it plays for today's generation.
We discuss changes in storytelling, styles, representation,
the making of each film, its initial reception, and how its meaning has changed over the years.
Join us as we explore cinema classics across generations on Generation Film.
Hey there, I'm DC. I host the rock podcast Back to the Arena, The Interviews. It's about a 30-minute podcast where I talk one-on-one with a band who has released new music. You can find us on all the best podcast sites like Spotify, Apple, Google, iHeartRadio, and more. If you're a rock fan like me, subscribe today to Back to the Arena, The Interviews.
Electricast. Electricast.